Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. We're glad to have you. But before you listen to this episode, if you have not yet listened to part one of The Exploits of Mad Jack Churchill, please go ahead and listen to that part before you listen to this episode so you know what's going on.
Totally. You might be asking yourself, why'd you make it two parts, guys? Well, we got to do two of these a week, and sometimes we just have to do ourselves a favor and make the occasional two-parter. But I think this one is perfect for it because there's a lot to it, a lot to unpack, Lots of cool details and Quentin Tarantino-esque bloodbathy scenarios involved in this man's life. So absolutely worthy of a two-parter. We bless you, Mad Jack, with a two-parter.
We had to learn about the bagpipe, too, so that took a second in our last episode. I'm Ben.
I'm Nolan. We're both pretty good now.
We're all right. Yeah, I think the coffee's kicking in. That's our super producer, Casey Pegram. On the ones and zeros, Casey, how you doing?
Doing great.
So good. Great. I mean, you could be, you know, here in the States, it's weird because a lot of my friends who are from different parts of the world always ask me about the American, especially the Southern American habit of asking people how they're doing. Because in a lot of countries, in a lot of cultures, you don't ask people that unless you really want to know.
Right.
And here the correct answer is like what you just said, Casey, like, great, fine.
Yeah. You ever say like, meh? Not so great. Could be better.
Yeah.
Don't want to bore you with the details, but I will.
Well, we live in corporate America, too, when we record this stuff, so it's amazing what you can get away with in the break room. I'm a big fan of just, you know, someone's given up on the day. If you say, hey, how's it going? And they say, oh, you know, living the dream, or like, Mondays.
Oh, got a bad case of the Mondays. You know, I got to say, though, Ben, starting off record this peek behind the curtain, we do these back-to-back, so it's still Monday, just like it was when we did part one of Mad Jack. And we don't typically record Mondays at 10 a.m., but you've been out of town for a bit, and we're kind of playing a little catch-up, and it's a nice way to set the tone for the day, being here in the shipping container, the sweltering, smelly shipping container with you and super producer Casey Pegram out there peering through the glass. It warms my heart. It really gives me a good way to kick off a Monday. So I don't have a case of the Mondays.
Awesome.
And if I do, it's a good thing. It's a disease that I relish.
Time zones are so messed up for me right now, man. It's probably going to be like 4:30 a.m. on a Saturday for me for most of the week. Mad Jack, though. This is a guy who lives in the moment. When we last left off with the adventures of Lieutenant Colonel Churchill, he was in his prime. He was seen as a living icon for the Allied forces, especially the British. And he was in charge of the number two commando. And the number two commando, they were literally, I think I can say this on this show, they were badasses. I could say badasses on the show, right?
Ben, you don't have to ask permission from me to say badasses.
I mean, the science teachers that we earlier built such a great relationship with during the Mpemba effect.
Yeah, when I said science was a sham.
We're obviously joking. I think we were obviously joking.
Oh, we were absolutely obviously joking. I think we're both big fans of science.
Yeah, it's the reason podcasts can happen. So anyway, Mad Jack Churchill, he is as much of a symbol as he is a soldier and a leader. And as you mentioned in our previous episode, Noel, this comes to a head at the Battle of Salerno in 1943. The number two commando group is tasked with stopping Germans from placing artillery fire on the western half of the bay. And surprise, surprise, Mad Jack is the man in charge of the final counterattack. We set up this episode with a question at the end of part one. Here's the thing. Mad Jack told his forces to shout something when they attacked. And it was part of this big strategy that he came up with, that he's still sort of famous for, because, you know, launching a counterattack is tough. Someone else is already sort of controlling the field.
That's right.
So what did he do?
Well, he did quite a lot, Ben. Here at the Battle of Salerno, he had a strategy in mind. He cut his men up into not cut them up literally with his broadsword, split them up is probably a more appropriate word, into six columns, flanks, right? Parallel columns under the cover of night. And the part of the field in which they were fighting was really densely overgrown. So his counterattack was very unlikely to catch the Germans off guard because of all the crunching and, you know, chopping through foliage they would have had to do to get to them, right? So he needed an edge, didn't he?
Yes. This is the greatest part. This was cracking me up over the weekend. Here's what Mad Jack does. He says, all right, we can't go in there quietly. We can't be subtle. So, guys, I want you to get a running start, and when you attack, I want you all to scream,
"Commando!" I'm sorry, what?
Just scream commando, which is, what is that film? I think it's with Will Ferrell where he's doing parkour but yelling parkour while he does it.
Well, that's also in The Office. This is an episode of The Office.
That's what I'm thinking of. Like, the
parkour,
Office.
Parkour. Yeah. It's so fantastic.
He basically makes them yell commando while they're doing commando stuff.
And also not wearing underpants, as it turns out. They're going commando, yelling. I never understood that. Why is going commando wearing no underpants?
I don't know, man. It's just sometimes life gets too real. You don't have time to wash your unmentionables.
Your government-issued skivvies?
Yeah, or, you know, you just, you got to cut down to the essentials.
That's right. I think it has to do with maneuverability, perhaps. You know, if you're not wearing any briefs, you got a little more wiggle room. Wow, okay, that sounds funny.
I don't know if that, but I mean, I would think the opposite, though, because, you know, if you got your Australia just going willy-nilly everywhere, you might have some maneuverability, but you're also going to be more vulnerable, right?
How do you think the science teachers are going to feel about this talk?
Well, the geography teachers might have a problem with me.
Little Australia? Yeah, not geographically accurate. No, but it's true. They yell commando. It really is like the Braveheart freedom kind of thing, you know? I mean, so again, like they know that they're not going to be they're not going to be able to do a covert kind of approach. So let's just take it all the way in the other direction, right? And just freak them out. It's really a kind of a theater of the mind almost, mm-hmm. right? Where you're catching them off guard in a different way by like surprising them literally by screaming this thing. Like, who would do that? What's going on?
And think about this too. There are some practical things. A lot of these guys in the German forces don't speak English, so they may not know the word commando exactly. It sounds like an English word, but then also this keeps the Allied forces from shooting each other. They can't see each other, so they know not to shoot in the direction of someone yelling commando.
So wait a minute. Are they yelling it just like repeatedly? Is it just the one time on the initial charge?
I think they might all be yelling commando the whole time. But it works. So they actually take almost 140 prisoners. And during this time, it's still not enough for Churchill. He decides to sneak out from camp one night with his corporal. And this is the next Tarantino moment. Casey, if you do the honors. Churchill and his corporal walk toward the town. They hope they're just going to catch a stray German or two. That'll be enough for their bloodlust. But then they hear Germans digging all around them. And so they have a cigarette lit. That's the only source of light. They sneak up on two Germans. And picture this. Churchill is coming out of the darkness. All you see is, like, the faint light from the cigarette.
Yeah.
The ember of the cigarette.
Right, which kind of, like, you know, illuminates and then dims with each drag, right?
Perfect. What do they see?
What they see is, for all intents and purposes, an insane man coming out of the darkness, sword aloft, swinging it hither and thither. And then he ordered the men, who were obviously peeing their pants, to, you know, put their hands up. And of course they complied, because what else are you going to do?
I mean, it was a stick-up with a sword.
Right.
They didn't even fight at that time. I conjecture that they had already knew about Mad Jack. Perhaps his reputation preceded him. And they thought, this is like being on the night shift of a construction crew, and then Batman comes to confront you.
I have to wonder if the character in Glorious Bastards, played by Eli Roth, the bear Jew, was in some way based on Mad Jack. Because, again, you know, just that, because the deal with that character was he used an anachronistic weapon, which is a baseball bat, right? And this is very similar to Mad Jack. We don't really have any accounts of him, like, unceremoniously murdering Nazis and hacking them to bits with his sword. But I'd like to believe that happened a time or two.
Yeah, that's the thing. We have to remember that a lot of the reporting of Churchill's adventures came from Allied sources that were going to definitely spin the narrative to serve their propaganda.
Because it's still a war crime if you murder, even if it's a Nazi. You know, you're supposed to take prisoners. That's sort of the rules.
I hope it's not a hot take, but I was always under the impression that murder in general was not a good look.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's true. Yeah. Agreed.
But you're right. You're right. There's probably a bit of a bit of embellishment, and maybe we're suppressing some of the uglier deeds. But war is war, and war is hell. So we know that he did take prisoners in this case. He didn't kill either of those guys. He left one prisoner with his corporal, and he took the other with him, using him as a human shield, which I think is actually a war crime.
Is it really?
I think it is, yeah.
Seems thrifty to me.
If it's a civilian, it's a war crime.
Right.
So
this guy was an approved human shield.
I guess so, yeah. He was a soldier. So we should say we are not experts on the Geneva Conventions. So Churchill takes his prisoner-turned-human shield and goes to the other Germans who are digging. And again, they're just – these guys are not expecting a war.
Are they digging, like, trenches or something? What are they digging, do you think?
Trenches, fortifications, probably, yeah. Something like
latrines
that.
Latrines even.
Latrines even. Yeah. Yeah, this wasn't the most glorious job. And then he still – again, he does not have a gun. He just has this sword, and he's walking around taking prisoners – kind of on a one-by-one or group-by-group basis. By the end of it, he has 42 prisoners. Again, he does not have a gun. He is one person with a sword, albeit a large sword.
Right.
And he's scaring 42 prisoners. He marches them all back, carrying their own weapons. They had weapons, by the way.
Yeah. It's kind of had a momentary lapse of reason, as Pink Floyd would like to say, where they just forgot because of the giant sword and the scary man.
Yeah.
I love this detail.
Yeah.
They're wounded. They dragged them in like a Bring Out Your Dead Monty Python-esque cart behind them. He's making them do all the work. He's one man marching them in a line. I don't understand. This does almost sound like propaganda. This is almost too good to be true.
42 people with guns. They have rifles. He later says something like, well, I always make my prisoners carry their own weapons. It slows them down for me. Come on, man.
Mm. Yeah, no. It's a bit much, but gosh, I love this character, and I can't believe there hasn't been some kind of, you know, dramatization of this guy's exploits, because it is good stuff, good fodder for cinema.
I often think, I feel like we're doing so much legwork for studios these days. It's probably about once a month I run into a story on Ridiculous History that I think should be a film.
Agreed.
Right?
Yeah.
It's weird how many are not films.
I mean, Hollywood's thirsty for stories. You know, maybe we should reach out to some folks and see if we can get EP credits.
Yeah, and they're finally being less gun-shy about original stories, you know?
Agreed. Ben, I don't know if you – I don't think you pointed this out, but they were carrying their own weapons, but he made sure to pull the firing pins or the bolts or whatever out.
Important.
Of them.
Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Important detail. I did not mention that. He did have them take the rifle bolts out, but still –
Oh, no.
A gun is a gun.
Oh, I mean, I'm not using that to diminish the impact of this story at all. And it did, in fact, earn him the first of two distinguished service orders that he received during his military career. And he ended up with 42 prisoners that he captured using only a sword and his pure, unadulterated bravado.
It wasn't all glory, trumpets, and angel farts, however. In 1944, he was sent to assist Tito's forces in Yugoslavia, Josip Broz Tito, and he led a full frontal assault on a tower that was very well defended. Churchill put together a motley crew. He had 1,500 partisans, people fighting in their native land. He had the group, the 43 Commando, and then he had one troop from 40 Commando. And he led the commando forces while partisans stayed at the landing area, but only Churchill and six other men made it to the objective. And Churchill himself was actually playing a bagpipe song. It's a song called "Will Ye No Come Back Again?" And while he was playing this, a mortar shell killed the other six men with him. He was the only person who survived. He was knocked unconscious, and he was captured.
Ben, were you taking some pronunciation licenses with that song title, or is it actually spelled in such a way that you would say it like that?
It is, yeah. I didn't take any license, no.
Got it. I love that. No, it's true. I mean, this guy was, in fact, like a real-life superhero. I mean, you know, you could call it happenstance. You could call it being in the right place at the right time, having good luck or whatever. But, I mean, this guy seemed to have been blessed in some way by the gods of war. I mean, yeah. He really, you know, cheated death multiple times. Again, I can't get away from the whole marching, screaming into battle, waving his sword, and his reliance on this sword and bow and arrow. And he never even, I mean, I'm sure he had weapons, you know, firearms, but you don't really hear much about him leaning too hard on those.
Yeah, it reminds me, I've been reading a lot of Conan the Barbarian. There's some great comics and graphic novels there. And this guy is like a World War II Conan the Barbarian. Conan worships, by the way, a god called Crom, who sits on a mountaintop and just judges people when they die. So maybe there was some sort of divine force of war at work in the life of Mad Jack Churchill, because something unusual happens when he gets captured. The Nazi forces have a standing order to kill this man immediately whenever the opportunity presents. But the officers who capture him ignore the order to kill him out of, get this, respect. They also assumed he was related to Winston Churchill. And so they said, okay, Churchill, let's send him to Berlin and let's interrogate him.
When we first started researching this, I may or may not have made that same mistake myself.
It's super understandable, right?
Yeah, it is. But again, this guy's reputation preceded him. He was legendary, even amongst his enemies, you know? I mean, to have your enemies respect you to that degree, that takes a lot of chutzpah.
It's true. So when they interrogated him, they found not only did he have no valuable information to offer them, but he was a huge problem prisoner. He started trash fires. He was raising Cain with the other prisoners and with the guards. Eventually, he was sent to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp, where, of course, many, many people would die. But he did not. He escaped the camp pretty quickly after being interned there, along with an officer from the Royal Air Force.
Yeah, they joined forces and shimmied under a wire fence and left through an abandoned storm drain. And then they walked 125 miles, by some accounts, closer to 90 by others, right through Nazi territory, straight to the Baltic Sea. And then they were captured a few miles from the shore, and then they were transferred to another camp in Italy. But once again, Churchill escaped that one too in 1945, where he snuck away during a blackout and walked another 100 miles using a rusty can to cook things that he pilfered, you know, the vegetables and such that he stole from these fields, literally stealing crops that Nazis had kind of commandeered, right?
Yeah, he was living a hobo life. For a second. And eventually he finds an American regiment in Verona, and he's able to convince them, I'm a British officer. He's probably, you know, he's probably at a bit of a loss without his broadsword, but he's saying something like, it's me, the broadsword guy. Hand me some bagpipes. I'll prove it to you. You know what I mean? Don't you want to hear? Will ye no come again? Mm-hmm. And he convinces them. So there's one other note here. That's pretty important. It comes to us from thevintagenews.com. He actually wanted to compliment one of the Germans that had held him as a prisoner, a guy named Captain Hans Thorner. Here's what Churchill wrote about him. He wrote a letter to Captain Thorner, actually, and he said, "You have treated us well. If after the war you are ever in England and Scotland, come and have dinner with my wife and myself." Pretty weird, right? I don't think a lot of prisoners write that kind of stuff to their prison guards and their wardens. Interestingly enough, this note later saved Thorner's life. He was going to be executed in Yugoslavia for war crimes. And then someone said, well, if Mad Jack likes him, he can't be all bad.
Exactly. I mean, he really was kind of a man of the people. And like we said at the top, kind of the born, I use the term raconteur because I just feel like that's someone who tells great stories and can kind of engender people's, hold people's attention, you know? I mean, it takes a lot of that storytelling ability to really rally people around you because you kind of have to control the narrative, right? And get people to kind of get behind you and trust you in that way. I think that was a skill that he definitely possessed.
He also remains in the army. A lot of people, when they escape like that, the government would be completely fine with them retiring, right, or being discharged, but not Churchill. As a matter of fact, in 1945, just a few months after he had met back up with the American forces, he was sent to Burma, and he was going to be in the Pacific Theater fighting battles on land against Japan. But by the time he finally got there, the war was wrapping up. Nagasaki and Hiroshima had been bombed, and Churchill was not happy. He wasn't upset about the nuclear deployment. He was upset because he thought the war was ending too soon, and reportedly said, if it wasn't for those damn Yanks, we could have kept the war going another 10 years.
Oh, wow. That's a hot take right there.
That's not what you would call on, my friend.
No, it's definitely not on. But this was the life that he was obviously best suited for. I can't imagine what his acclimation back into civilian life must have been like. You can't just go brandishing your sword into the old corner bakery, right?
Right, yeah. You can't try to intimidate your Uber driver with bagpipes, though I bet someone's tried.
I bet.
So he wants to continue this lifestyle with which he is so well acquainted. He qualifies as a parachutist. He's in his 40s at this point, and he joins the Highland Light Infantry, where he moves to Palestine, which is occupied by British forces at this time, and he trains with the British Army to fight Arab forces. And while he's there, he's also coordinating rescue efforts and evacuation efforts for civilians that are under attack.
Yeah, he actually was a multiple hero. He saved 500 patients and some of the staff at the Hadassah Hospital, which was near Jerusalem. And then he eventually went back to England. He refurbished steamboats. I mean, like, this guy was just an absolute gem. Continued his motorcycling career, and I imagine, you know, kept shooting arrows, just not so much at Nazis.
Yeah, his love of arrows follows him throughout his life. He also eventually decides to move away from the UK. And he says, you know what? My battling days are done. What's next? What's my third act in life? What is the epilogue for Mad Jack Churchill? And he thinks about it and he says, you know what? I'm going to move to Australia. So he moves to Australia. He teaches land air warfare, but spends most of his free time becoming a surfer. So he goes to Australia, he surfs for a while, and he's a teacher. He later goes back to England, and he designs his own surfboards, and he becomes the first person to surf the 5-foot tidal bore of the River Severn while he's working a desk job.
And then he started the famous Ron John surf shop, known the world over.
Mainly in Panama City, right?
Pretty much.
Is it an East Coast thing?
I think it is.
Okay.
Well, is it? I don't know. Casey, what do you know about Ron John?
I feel like it's, yeah. I've only encountered it on the East Coast, but that's because I've mostly been on the East Coast.
Like Myrtle Beach and stuff like
totally,
that.
Totally. Myrtle Beach, 1,000%. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll solve the mystery of Ron John for another episode. By the time Mad Jack retires from the Army, it's 1959. He is 53 years old, and he spends the last he lives for a while. He spends the last almost 40 years, 37 years of his life sailing ships along the Thames and piloting radio-controlled model warships. Which is weird, but seems like a happy ending for such a violent life.
It's on brand that he was able to take a little bit of that warlike instinct and bloodlust and just turn it into a nice hobby, mm-hmm. you know, piloting remote control ships. That's nice.
And his son said he was super chill. Did you see that part?
No, I didn't.
His son said, you know, actually, my dad was a very unassuming man, and he always told me people are less likely to shoot you if you smile at them. So the propaganda machine that we mentioned earlier is still going, by the way. Mad Jack Churchill becomes the protagonist of a comic strip. There are books written about him, and he is called one of, if not the most inspirational, impressive people that the Norwegian Royal Explorers Club has ever researched.
There's a great quote on Churchill from Espen Lazarus, who is the co-founder of the Norwegian Royal Explorers Club. And he said of Jack Churchill that he was, quote, one of, if not the most inspirational and impressive people we have researched in relation to this book. And that book in question was sort of a compilation volume of accounts of various historical explorers and adventurers that this organization put together. And you know, Churchill continued on in his kind of eccentric, marching to the beat of his own drummer kind of ways. He would, there's an article from All That's Interesting, allthatisinteresting.com about Mad Jack, talking about how he would take the train from the city to where he lived out in the country, and he would often toss his briefcase out the window. And then he was asked why he would do that. He told the conductor that he was simply throwing his briefcase into his own backyard so he wouldn't have to carry it home from the station.
Which I kind of get. If you've ever ridden a train system regularly, there's this weird thing where you'll pass by your own house, but you can't get off because you have to go to the station.
That's right.
So I could see the efficiency there. Weird thing about Jack Churchill, and always reminds me of how close we all are to history. The weird thing about this guy is that he didn't pass away until 1996, the same year the Olympics were in Atlanta. Just to ground this in modern history, he was 89 years old, and his legacy remains pretty popular. But there's one thing we have to mention. Let's drill into this just a little bit. We talked about his anachronistic weapon choice, and we also talked about whether he deserves to be worshipped or lionized the way he is. And we have a little bit of we have a little bit of perspective from an historian named Mike Lodes about how useful this longbow and this claymore, this broadsword, may have been during war.
Yeah, so based on some images of Churchill that were kind of analyzed, this gentleman, historian by the name of Mike Lodes, decided that both were incredibly effective, potentially, of maiming and killing people. The bow that he used was lightweight, was under 40 pounds versus those medieval bows you might know that were quite tall and that were almost 100 pounds each. And then 180-pound modern bows used in war, which would have, you know, had more of a compound kind of situation, right? And like we mentioned before, the bow was a silent killer. You know, you'd never hear it coming, except for maybe a little whoosh.
Right. And Lodes says that Churchill wasn't really one for stealth outside of the quiet, deadly, silent bow. After all, he was a guy known to scream, "Commando!" when he ran at people. Historians think this was, like we had said, a sort of a psychological tactic. It was meant to intimidate the enemy into fearing that charge. But this probably wasn't the most efficient tactic because the clatter and clutter of a sword wouldn't be helpful. This led historians, again, like Mike Lodes, to say his tendency to love the sword was probably an affectation of sorts. His survival, in fact, may have had just as much to do with his image as an insane person as it did with his skill. Like, German forces who saw him on the beach remembered the day, and later some of those German forces were taken prisoner, and prisoners who remembered seeing Churchill playing the pipes on the beaches of Normandy said that they didn't fire at him because they thought he was crazy. They felt sorry for him. So there was there was intimidation on the Axis side, but there was also pity and confusion when it came to Mad Jack. And then again, we have to come back to it. There's that one quote that gives us a troubling look into his mind where he says, "We could have kept the war going for another 10 years. Who wants war to keep going, right?
I don't know, someone whose skill set is particularly suited for a perpetual state of war. But it was nice to know that he did kind of mellow out in his old age and play with, you know, model boats.
It's true. Happy endings are often all too rare in the stories of war. And so with that, we bid adieu to Lieutenant Colonel John Malcolm Thorpe Fleming Churchill, also known as Mad Jack. What do you think, Noel? Do we play this out with some bagpipes, or should we just let it go? I've heard a lot of bagpipes today.
I think we absolutely have to play it out with some bagpipes, Ben.
All right.
Huge thanks to Mad Jack for being one of history's most fascinating badasses, I don't mind saying. And equal thanks for being one of history's most badass producers, super producer Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who did not compose this bagpipe ditty. He did compose our theme, which we'll probably be returning to at a later date. We're going to play out on this whole bagpipe situation, I think. Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit. Gabe Luzier for all of his research chops.
Big thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister, as well as Eve's Jeffcoat. This concludes our episode, but not our show. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us some more about little-known heroes, villains, or plain old eccentrics from the days of yore. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. I especially like to recommend our Facebook group page, Ridiculous Historians. All you have to do to sign up is name me or my trusty co-host or Casey, or honestly, just drop a terrible joke in there. And if it's chuckle-worthy, I'll let you in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're pretty easily amused, so it doesn't take much. But just let us know that you're not a Russian bot, as I like to say, on our other show, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, which you can also check out on the internet and on the Facebook. If you want to check Ben and I out as individual human people, you can do so at your leisure. I am on Instagram exclusively at HowNowNoelBrown.
And I am on Instagram in a burst of creativity at Ben Bolin. I am also on Twitter as at Ben Bolin HSW. Oh, thank you. Casey, I just have to say, you're just killing it with the music today, man. And before we go out, I think maybe we need to give you the last word because you have an update on our surf shop question.
Yeah, we could not let this episode go by without clarifying this very, very important point. Where is the Ron John surf shop franchise centered? Well, it is mostly in Florida, but there are also a couple shops in South Carolina, the aforementioned Myrtle Beach, Alabama, Maryland, New Jersey. They also have some in airports. They have some in Cozumel in Mexico. They have one on Grand Turk and the Turks and Caicos. They have one in Las Vegas. They also have the Ron John Surf School and the Ron John Kite School. Who saw that one coming?
Not I. I'll tell you who did, though. Casey.
Casey on the case.
I'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.